Hey everyone, it's Lauren. In less than a year, the coronavirus has changed life as we know it, from job losses to evictions, and even the loss of loved ones. And as we enter the fall and back to school season, we wanted to know, what does education look like in the midst of a pandemic? And how can we keep students, educators, and workers safe? That's why we spoke to Tiara and Cameron Kennedy, two parents who are concerned about schools reopening and what the future of education will look like for their three daughters.
Yes, there's going to be major setbacks because in-person learning is more educational, obviously. And it's going to be hard on the parents.
This is Cameron.
A lot of parents are not going to be computer literate. It's going to be setbacks. It's going to be difficult no matter how they go forward, but they're going to need a plan on how to do it, either way it goes.
The Kennedys live in the Riverview Garden School District, which will be 100% virtual for the first quarter. But the uncertainty can weigh heavily on parents during this time.
Everything is changing. It's becoming, I feel like it's unorganized, which I also understand that this is new to everybody.
And this is Tiara.
It's frustrating. I've been checking my emails constantly trying to figure out like, okay, what's the plan today? What's the plan? Have anything changed? You know, so I feel like it's a constant running back and forth, like a juggle almost, not knowing, okay, are the kids doing 100% virtually, which I do know that now, or are they going to do groups of A and B, or, you know, what websites do they need to go on to be on this virtual learning? It's a lot, and it's frustrating, and I feel like I'm going to have anxiety afterwards.
Tiara says adjusting to the constant changes is a daily process, and the possibility of schools opening for in-person learning in the spring semester is just as concerning.
I'm just honestly going with the flow of things, trying to keep up with all the information that the school is giving us. Honestly, I'm not prepared for the spring semester as far as what it may look like.
But for Cameron, it's all about implementing a concrete plan.
We need to see execution in the fall, post the colds, the flu season, combined with coronavirus, of course. You definitely want to see progress by fall before you even focus on the spring, I think. I think that they're looking too far out ahead without focusing on what's going on now. They already lost a lot of time. They got a lot of catching up.
And even if schools catch up and implement a better system, the daily concerns for parents still exist, especially financially, when many public schools don't have the funding to support virtual learning for every child.
They are trying. Even the school district here, they're trying. They're trying to distribute laptops. It's not like they don't want to. They need funding. Even with the food, they are doing food banks different times of the week, different times of the month. They're not doing as much as needed because they don't have the funding to provide for the public like they really need to, but they are trying. It's not like they're not out here getting together. They really are putting things together, putting out emails, calling the public. It's just at the end of the day, it's limited supply and it's running out fast, and it's a lot more people needed than those who don't. And that's where the issue lies. This city as a whole, most of the state, with Kansas City and St. Louis, we understand the differences in living standards within the inner cities and how the school systems work. And the less funded and the more funded. Really, it takes a lot of reform, period, from a lot of levels that it's just been exposed throughout the school systems. I believe that you can see the difference in who will receive education in which areas opposed to who won't because of the funding of which schools, or they're private or they're public. It's a lot more than that really meets the eye, but it's all combined and it's coming to a head within the school system, I think.
Funding from school district to school district has historically shown the difference between the more affluent areas and the less affluent areas. But education isn't the only area in which we see racial inequities.
If you want to send the kids back to school, make sure everyone have some type of health care, free health care, just in case their child gets sick and, you know, they have to go to the hospital.
Or affordable for everyone.
Yeah, or at least affordable.
Yeah. They do have affordable health care. We understand that, but it's still not universal. It's a difference.
While the inequities in health care unfold during a pandemic, children are also getting a real-world education. seeing on a daily basis the new uprising for Black lives and what work there is still left to do in terms of equality.
It's been stressful for the kids, obviously. They've been in pretty much in the house since March. They're adjusting well. We try to keep them up to date on what's going on in the world. Whether it's, and being home, they're seeing a lot more than what they normally would. The protests, the killings by police officers, they're seeing a lot more than they normally would see on a daily. And honestly, when this is over, whether it's next year or whenever, the children of this generation is going to be different. They're going to be more
in tune with the real world.
Yeah, they're going to be very in tune with the real world, I believe.
You know, they ask us questions and we try to give them honest answers without too much information that would like change their child mind or child state. But I feel like they've been woken up to a lot of things, which is good in a way, which is good, period. But at the same time, I feel like it's growing them up faster than what they should.
But the real world education isn't just for kids. Cameron says it's been a lesson in disguise for everyone.
Pandemic, this coronavirus, COVID-19 has been a learning process for everyone of all races. It's been history lessons. It's been death. It's been pain. It's been educational. It's been all the above. Like the last 6 months has been a different time for, I believe, the whole globe, not just America, not just St. Louis, not just our district. It's been for the world. Like, everybody is seeing the unjust system that's here. They are seeing the diversity within the poverty level, and the wealthy, you know, seeing the difference between each. They're seeing it even more because the rate in which people of color are dying opposed to people who's not. And that goes back to the healthcare, which we talked about. All this is coming to a head all at one time during a major election. And going forward, I just feel like on the other side of this is going to be a different outlook for everyone.
And when we asked what is carrying the Kennedy family through this unprecedented time, one word rang true.
Hope. You got to have hope to get to the end. Like, no matter what's going on, we don't hope for the best and wish for the best. It's not time for negativity. We need more positive things in the world right now.
So in this episode, we hear from two teachers, one who will share what it's like to teach through a pandemic and another who has been organizing teachers to advocate for safer policies and practices in the St. Louis public school system. And we'll talk to a student advocate and a financial aid advisor from a local nonprofit scholarship organization about how COVID-19 is affecting college students and what it means to put a racial equity lens on the student loan crisis. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. As parents navigate new routines and adjust to virtual learning software, educators are adapting too, as school districts decide whether or not to reopen. To understand what this new reality is like for teachers, we spoke to Tiffany Sean, a teacher with over 15 years of experience. Like the Kennedy family, Tiffany reminds us that the pandemic and the recession will affect those who are already at risk.
The children most at risk are the Black and brown children right now across the country. Because we all know the numbers of, you know, which race is more affluent than the rest. And so they won't be harmed as much. They could either afford someone to stay home with their kids or switch up their flexible schedule to just stay home with their kids to watch them. But it is the schools that are in impoverished neighborhoods where those families are going to be, they're going to be hit the hardest with this. And so I know my school, we have a few social emotional counselors. We've even been able to hire an extra person just to make sure that there are people reaching out to families, trying their best to make their needs met. I mean, we can't come in your house and, you know, take care of business for you, but schools do know of a lot of resources that families may not know of. And that's the hope is that we can at least lessen the stress that the families are going to feel in some of these neighborhoods that are not only being hit the hardest with COVID, but they're also just already hit the hardest economically.
Even though Black and brown folks will be hit the hardest, one thing that they have always depended on is their community and the support from one another to help them get through tough times.
Being proactive and looking for the resources that can help with whatever is needed. And then building villages. Like, I have a friend whose daughter is going into sixth grade. And while a sixth grader can stay home by themselves, you don't want your child at home just every day, all day. And so this friend is able to, she changed up her work schedule a bit. So she kind of had to beg her, employer to allow her to work from home because her job can be done at home. So she'll do that for 2 days. But then I told her if she just, really needs somebody for her child, at least one day a week, she can bring her child here. So while that is possibly bringing risk into my home and bringing risk into her home, because her child will be here with me, is giving that child a place to go so that she doesn't have to be home. So the villages really have to step up for each other. And even people who don't have a lot of family and friends, they have to find them somewhere. Like, this is really testing people to show them, like, how have I grown, my community within my own community.
Tiffany teaches in the Hazelwood School District, a mostly Black school district located in North St. Louis County. It's one of the largest school districts in Missouri and had to respond quickly to the pandemic.
I feel like they were one of the first ones to say they would go virtual. And it didn't happen right away, because in their July board meeting, they were actually very adamant about you were going to start in person and, it's going to work out fine. This is how it's just going to have to be. And then I was just like, nah, I'm not. That's not how it's going to be. Like, there's no way, from the numbers that we were all seeing, it didn't make sense that even in person could happen for now back in July. So then when they had their August 4th board meeting, it was like a complete switch, where then the superintendent was like, there's no way we can start in person. It's just not the safest thing. So even teachers are lucky enough to be able to use their discretion of either working in the building if they want to, because some people do want to work away from home and they have that option.
Having the option to work in the school building or from home goes a long way, especially for teachers with small children like Tiffany, because it can reduce the financial burden of childcare. But as the first quarter comes to a quick end in October, schools face questions about reopening for in-person learning or staying virtual.
I feel like they're going to have to make a decision within the next few weeks about second quarter. So it's not like they can wait until October to decide what to do for second quarter. So they're going to have to decide pretty quick, do we stay virtual or do we go into the building? Now, even once we go into the building, there are a group of students in our district who will be virtual all year long. So the parents had to make that decision. And it's hard for parents because they do have to stick with that. But it's also a scheduling thing. It'd be a nightmare if people could just kind of change their mind whenever they felt like it. So when we go back into the building, whenever that happens, second quarter, third quarter, whenever, there's a group that will stay virtual. They'll have their same teacher because that teacher has been deemed the virtual teacher for that grade level.
100% virtual learning can be difficult for many families that lack access to technology or Wi-Fi. The Hazelwood School District was able to secure laptops for students, but it wasn't easy.
Our district was able to secure enough laptops for everybody. It took a very long time. Like, I think even right now, 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, there are still students from my school that haven't been able to pick theirs up yet, but it's because everybody in the country needed more devices. And so it just took a longer time to get it to the schools and then to get it out to families who kind of had to rearrange their schedules just to be able to go up to the schools to pick up what they needed. So that access is definitely difficult. So I worry about that for sure.
And even when the students get access to a laptop and Wi-Fi, there are still concerns about computer literacy, distractions, and more.
Internet can go out whenever it feels like it. It may not be the best. If you have multiple kids at home, they're all trying to stream at the same time. These schedules for virtual learning is seeming like a lot, but I feel like they had to start with super high expectations, and then we can kind of go from there and take back what we put out there, because I'm looking at some of the teachers' schedules at my school, and it's almost looking like kids are at their computer from 8:50. They get they get 30 minutes of a lunch break, and they've got small group time and independent time worked in there, but they're at their laptops from 8:50 until 3:50. that's a lot to ask. Like, my charger is not even going to last that long. So even things like that, I have to be in a spot, me as the adult, in a spot where I can charge my laptop whenever I need it. Like, how's a child supposed to keep up with that for themselves?
Virtual learning can also impact a child's access to a safe learning environment and their ability to form meaningful relationships.
So much of it has to do with social emotional, just like the social emotional health of students. And I get that. I do. I know not everybody's home life is filled with, you know, adults who are trying to think of how to say this in the nicest way, who have their best interests basically at heart. I get that. There's some situations that I wish kids did not have to be in. But at the same time, just going back, because kids need to socialize and they need to see their teacher face to face every day, that is not worth the risk of possibly catching this virus. So that's really the main thing, because you can get your academics through the internet. It's very possible. People have proved that. There are people who homeschool all the time, who do virtual learning all the time. Like, this is not necessarily new, it's just new as a requirement.
But as school administrators weigh the cost and benefits of reopening, teachers like Tiffany remain concerned about how students and staff can remain safe when social distancing in a classroom is challenging, if not impossible.
We are trying to be positive about this. The pandemic itself is not positive, so we all have that kind of lingering over us, but we're trying. Teachers are trying. We want to work with the families. We want to make this as seamless as possible. We know it will not be easy, so we all have to kind of have that realism, just to know this is going to be difficult. Kids are going to have to not learn in their traditional way and just, you know, find a quiet space if possible in your house to work. Like, even now I'm rethinking my dining room table as the desk for me and my two children, because they are constantly in my business. And so it has not been easy. I have one now crying, trying to come to me.
Back in mid-July, St. Louis Public School teachers staged a socially distanced sit-in outside of the St. Louis Public Schools headquarters to demand that schools halt reopening plans in places where COVID-19 cases are rising.
I was definitely proud of them for standing up and just saying, this is not going to work. When you have a class, at the most, I think the biggest class I've had, it was when I was teaching charter schools, early 2000s, close to 30. It was not 30, but it was like 28. It was super close. How are you supposed to distance in a classroom that, you know, is the size of a bedroom, so to say? Like, these are not halls that we're in. These are small classes. And by halls, I'm meaning like an auditorium type place. Like, it's not like we can spread ourselves out that much. And I've seen some of the pictures of people who do have to go back to class and just how they've tried to distance. Like, I know one friend, her husband teaches in some part of Alabama, I believe, and he's high school, and they've already gone back. He actually removed the desks and just has students sitting in their chairs and working on their laps, because it was easier to keep the students spread out if the desks weren't in the way. And it's like, that's great for him, because he is trying, but that's ridiculous. Like, now a child doesn't have a comfortable space really to work. Like, you're stuck kind of hunching over in your chair writing. But it was the best solution he could come up with, just to try and keep everybody, including himself, safe, because he's got a wife and two kids to go to at home. So, you know, he doesn't want to risk anything for himself as well as those who are there with him. So I think it's that social distance piece that's the biggest for me.
She's even more concerned about what that means if there's another wave of COVID-19 cases during flu season.
And then, of course, just the sanitizing. The flu, when flu season comes around, it runs rampant in a classroom. I've even seen things like lice go around the classroom like crazy. So these viruses that we've already had, and just things you could catch, just sicknesses and everything you catch, already have been running rampant through classrooms. Why not this? Like, COVID is not exempt from everything else that's already been going through our classrooms. The issue is the consequences are just harsher.
Balancing life as an educator and a parent has its challenges, but Tiffany says it's the little things that can make a difference right now.
My faith in God. I was even talking to my daughter today, and she's only four, but she was telling me how she prayed that people wouldn't be sick anymore. And I was like, you just have to keep praying. Like, it's not going to happen overnight. We have to just, you know, try to get through this, and just finding something to make us happy. Like, whether that's a new TV show, a nice drink at the end of the night, like something, just doing something self-care-ish to make you happy, and kind of tuning out the outside stuff. That's what I have to try to do.
As Tiffany explained to her daughter, containing the pandemic and working toward a just recovery will take time. The path to reopening schools is a long one as well, according to Ribbon Williams, a teacher and one of the organizers of the mid-July sit-in outside of the St. Louis Public Schools headquarters. And that's because a safe reopening requires shifting systems that impact well-being for the whole child.
It's a large task for a huge number of people. It's not something that any particular person can help or any particular person can do. This is like something that we all have to activate ourselves. When we talk about systems that needed to be changed, if you go back to any huge thing that's connected to African Americans, nothing changed for us overnight. The bus boycott, that was a year. Like they said, we're not getting on. We are going to come up with systems to get each other from place to place, and we're just not going to patronize. And this isn't something that we're going to be able to change overnight. It's going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of different things to move us on to the next level. But we have to have people who are determined and who are paying attention to all the little pieces that can connect to make huge change for the world in general.
Ms. Ribbon has been teaching at St. Louis Public Schools for 5 years and is teaching fourth and fifth grade this year. But she's also a full-time student working toward a doctor of education.
I'm a student, so I've done a lot of research around public education, teacher contracts, and different things that kind of led me to the place where I felt like it was time for us to do a sit-in, because our contracts were in the process of being negotiated. It's technically not a strike because we were working during that time. I felt like it was the perfect opportunity for our voices to be heard, because we hadn't at that point been surveyed for our input regarding how we could, how we would proceed with the school year for this school year.
In the summer, St. Louis Public School administrators solicited suggestions about reopening schools from teachers and support staff via email.
There was a place for teachers and staff to say, this is my suggestion. But in terms of there being some communication that was sent to us asking us who could work, who was high risk, and all those things, we just didn't receive anything that asked us how we felt about returning and if we could return safely.
She adds that many teachers and staff may have missed this communication because some may not check their emails during the summer. In preparation for the sit-in, Ms. Ribbon worked with her colleague, Grace Hogan, to create a 15-page report of recommendations for school reentry. While Ms. Hogan researched other reopening plans, Ms. Ribbon surveyed St. Louis Public Schools staff, healthcare professionals, district staff, and college professors to come up with questions to consider when preparing for reentry.
What would you say if you could give feedback, if you had to give input? What are some of the things that you would want to be considered? And then I took all of that information and put it together, which ended up being a 15-page document that we presented to the district and we presented to the union so that the union could go over the information and use those demands to try to help with the reopening plan that they originally submitted to the public.
They relied on social media and virtual meetings to organize with other teachers and school support staff.
We were meeting over Zoom. We were communicating on the phone. We were communicating via social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and talking to each other on Messenger, which we communicate regularly on Messenger. That was the way that we got the amount of support. We created the Expect Better Facebook page the same day of the protest.
They also used the hashtag 14 days no new cases, which educators across the nation are using to demand a slowdown in COVID-19 cases before schools reopen. Immediately, they received messages of support.
Supporters kept asking us, like, how do we support? What do we do? What's next? Do we want to go to Jeff City? Like, what's the plan? And so we created the Expect Better page that same day. And then we're like maybe like 900 members now from doing the sit-in.
That attention from the public opened up a dialogue about reopening schools between the leaders of the Expect Better group of teachers and support staff and the St. Louis Public Schools Administration.
We just wanted to be included in the conversation, and there was a piece missing because although this is something that we've never experienced before, there were opportunities for school districts in general, all school districts in general, to kind of get an idea of what would be most suitable for everybody. And it's not specifically about one particular group or another. We just need to be able to, if you trust us to be responsible for these tiny humans all the time, I really feel like it's necessary that you include us in the conversation when we start thinking about how we could do this and make it work.
Ms. Ribbon says that since the sit-in, St. Louis Public Schools has followed up with teachers and support staff and asked for additional feedback and input on school reopening plans, but there has been a major increase in the number of teachers and staff who are speaking up and offering their perspectives than when school administrators initially solicited feedback in the summer.
If you go against any system, people are just afraid to do that. And even if it's something that the collective believes is just wrong, people are still afraid to speak out. So after we did the sit-in and teachers started being more confident and staff became more confident and stakeholders became more confident, then they were more vocal. They started sending emails. And whenever you go from the board meetings that happened prior to the sit-in, if you go to YouTube, you can look and see how much participation they had, what questions that were presented from viewers prior to the protest and what the difference is afterwards. There's a lot of activity, a lot of questions, a lot of engagement. We are not necessarily as afraid to just ask the question.
Underlying those questions from teachers and support staff are also concerns about racial equity.
Many of our students were already at a disadvantage, and we wanted to make sure that the reopening plan included some type of stipulation that would help that group of students. On top of that, we have African-American teachers, African-American custodians, African-American support staff that need to be Black and brown people who need to be supported because we are in a group of people who are more at risk. So making sure that the powers that be are aware that it's not just students and it's not just staff, it's everybody. We have one student who might go into a building and come in contact with the virus, and then that could go from that student into their whole entire family. We have children who live with grandparents, aunts and uncles. That could affect way more people for our population with minimal health care and disproportionate numbers in our community, that the effects would be totally different than it would in another environment.
But even though the St. Louis Public School District is majority African-American, Ms. Ribbon emphasizes that similar questions are being asked in districts across the country.
Everyone is trying to see how this works and taking it one day at a time. Because I asked our union president the other day, what's the plan when we try to go back to brick and mortar? Is that something that we're working on right now? And his response was that we're weighted so heavily right now with just trying to get through virtual. We have so many hands on trying to figure out the virtual part. We don't have the bandwidth to try to navigate through that part yet because we just haven't gotten to that place yet. We just have too many needs and concerns for the present that you kind of got to take it minute by minute. So there isn't necessarily a plan other than we have to wait and see what happens.
It's difficult for school administrators to plan for reopening because there are many factors outside of their control that affect whether or not it is safe to do so.
I believe that the only way that we can really get to the real root of this is by having a support from the city and the state and the government. Like, that has to happen because every single area where there's a hole or a gap, it's not connected to education. It's not connected to any deficiency in education. The deficiencies in education come from systems.
And there are a lot of systems that impact our students, When schools first closed to prevent the spread of COVID-19, teachers like Ms. Ribbon were faced with figuring out how to make sure their students had food to eat and their households had basics like toilet paper and dishwashing liquid. Childcare and the availability of COVID-19 tests were another major concern.
All of the places where we could do and we should be able to support and help, those are areas that we really shouldn't be responsible for.
And even if COVID-19 cases decline, students' basic needs will persist.
If we go 14 days with no cases, what happens on the 15th day?
This question and questions like it are fueling Ms. Ribbon's research, which has taken a turn since the pandemic.
So I already had my topic and everything picked out, and then I started thinking about this. This is a gap. This is the gap that we always talk about. This is the gap. This is the ultimate gap.
That gap is the emerging research on how COVID-19 has changed teaching and learning milestones for a whole generation of students.
I know that there are a lot of skills and there's a lot of different standards that students need to learn by this time and things that they need to have by the time that they get to a certain point, but none of that helped them during this process. Those skills didn't matter when we got down to educating the whole child. What are we going to do with the student as a whole? How will you eat? How will you survive? How will your mental health be addressed?
And Ms. Ribbon wrestles with those questions. She's hoping that the public will start asking questions of their own about how society can balance its commitment to education while understanding how workers' rights relate to teachers and school support staff.
Why some of the laws are the way that they are and what motivates our systems to have like certain states who can go on strike, certain states who can't. At the end of the day, this is a job, but I also have a job to be a parent and be alive so that I can do that job as well. So we know that there's that public education and education in general, that it's a business, but we still have to try to look at policies and make them work so that they benefit everybody and that somebody in a certain subgroup doesn't feel like they're being left out of what it takes to be a true part of the system. Like, you don't want to feel like you're being made to do something. You want to feel like you're a part of the decision-making process, no matter what level you are. If you're a custodian, if you're an ISS monitor, you don't want to feel like you're just being told, this is your job and you're just going to do what I tell you to do. You really want to feel like you're a part of a greater good, so to speak.
And it's that desire to be a part of a greater good that's carrying Ms. Ribbon through this time.
Just my passion for my culture, my passion for education, my past, and what I know it means for my community, that we address many of the areas where we already knew there were deficiencies. I'm getting by knowing that there's a lot of people that are working on the back end. I went to the march on Washington Friday, and those are the types of things that are carrying me over to the next place, because I know it's a lot of people who are advocating and actually actionable things to try to change the way that systems are designed. And that's what's keeping me afloat right now.
Reopening schools is even more complicated for college students who are navigating their education along with housing and finances. So up next, we talk to a student advocate and a financial aid advisor from a local nonprofit scholarship organization about how COVID-19 is affecting college students and what it means to put a racial equity lens on the student loan crisis.
Hey everyone, it's Jalian. Across the country, reports are emerging about how COVID-19 is affecting college campuses that have reopened for in-person classes. And locally, universities have been hit by the virus as well. At the end of June, a local HBCU, Harris Stowe State University, closed because 8 administrative employees tested positive for COVID-19. In mid-July, graduate social work and public health students at Washington University in St. Louis started a petition demanding that the university default to online classes, which has now garnered over 200 signatures. In early August, 22 St. Louis University students tested positive for COVID-19 right before in-person classes began. And as of September 4th, the University of Missouri-Columbia has over 500 active student cases, and over 800 student cases have been reported in the county in which the university is located. Columbia, Missouri is now one of the top 10 metropolitan areas with the greatest number of new cases relative to its population. Behind those statistics are hundreds of students making difficult decisions about education, health, finances, and housing.
So many colleges spent so much time just publicly denying that we were in a crisis.
That's Carissa Anderson, Advocacy Director at the Scholarship Foundation of St. Louis.
They could have really been using that time to make sure they had adequate systems to support online learning, because it's my belief that by mid-semester, that's where most, if not all, will be, as we see outbreaks happening across the state, across the country, at colleges and universities, because it's illogical to think that it wouldn't spread on campus. It just, I don't know how they came to that conclusion, and no matter really what you do, because colleges are little towns, basically. And so there's just so much overlap. It's hard to keep people from socializing when they haven't seen each other in months, so on and so forth. It's just impossible.
The virus makes pursuing a higher education even more difficult for low-income Black and Brown students.
Everything was already so fragile, right? And it took it doesn't take much to knock things completely off course for the majority of the students that we work with. Stuff like a flat tire can completely derail a person's education. And so what we've seen over this spring semester into the summer is everything from entire families being impacted by the virus. We have students who are the breadwinners for their families, and they lost that job. We've seen student parents, right, who have children try and figure out, there's one computer, you know, trying to figure those things out. We have everything you can think of, any situation you can think of, we've seen it happen with our students. Students who in March, you know, were high school seniors thinking they were going to some school and then had to rapidly figure out how to change plans, which is not easy to do, changing plans that quickly for college, especially with financial aid and things of that nature.
She says it's been hard to get a hold of school administrators, even though colleges and universities have changed policies during the pandemic.
There have been extra things put into things like housing contracts, for example, clauses that won't let students get refunds if, for example, a campus has to close, or meal plans are more expensive and have little clauses in there. And if you're 18, 19, 20, I'm 29, sometimes we don't always read those little paragraphs at the end of a contract, you know, so things like that from a policy standpoint is really alarming.
It's also been nerve-wracking for some students to navigate on-campus housing without guarantees that they could protect themselves and others from the virus.
Every campus handled it differently. I spoke with some students who were going to have their own room.
That's Teresa Steinkamp, Advising Director for the Scholarship Foundation.
They did not have to have a roommate, and they would have been able to isolate or quarantine in their dorm on campus with knowledge that the school was going to provide for them meals and other necessary items while they were in isolation or quarantine. But then I spoke with other students who were going to be sharing a room with a roommate, and they didn't know the roommate, and that was a source of anxiety and concern for them. So I don't think that there has been any uniform approach across college campuses.
For the most part, Carissa and her colleagues at the Scholarship Foundation have advised their students to take college communications with a grain of salt since re-entry plans are constantly changing and differ across schools. But that's shifted the burden of making contingency plans onto the students, who have to ask themselves questions that are hard to answer in such an uncertain time.
Are you comfortable with online classes? And if you're not, have you considered taking a semester off? Is there benefit to taking a semester back and saving money or working on other things and trying again in the spring? Doesn't signal anything about your character or your commitment to yourself or your education to do that.
She's seen how the pandemic has made it harder for students to pay for their education.
It is not unusual in late July and early August to have students scrambling trying to cover a bill. That is not a new phenomenon. Unfortunately, it is exacerbated this year because students weren't able to connect in person with their support networks late in the spring and the early part of the summer. So we do see students contacting us for additional resources. We see students who are maxing out what they need to borrow in federal loans and still having a gap. And those are hard conversations because sometimes the conversation is maybe we need to have a different plan in place for the fall.
The coronavirus-induced recession has also introduced extra hurdles for students to access financial aid.
They had to go back in and make adjustments to their FAFSA because they needed to change to a different school, or there had been a job loss or a reduction in income due to a parent being furloughed, and so they had to talk to their college about a professional judgment review or an appeal to have their FAFSA adjusted. We had students who had to go through verification, and verification happens every year, and students who are verified oftentimes have to do it every single year. But we had students who couldn't get the necessary documentation from the IRS because the IRS wasn't mailing things. And so then they're spinning their wheels in the financial aid office. And then there's the financial aid office who's got this increased volume. And so it's what, August 27th, and there are students who have started their classes within the last week or two, and I'm still getting text messages from students saying, the financial aid office is asking me for yet another document, and I don't know what this is and why they still need it.
To help students plan for the fall semester, the Scholarship Foundation sent an assessment to over 400 students who were awarded interest-free loans or grants.
We asked students to think about their housing arrangements. So, like, hypothetical worst case scenario, if your campus closed tomorrow and they made you leave and they would not refund you, would you still be able to put a roof over your head and food on the table, or would you be in a pinch financially? Because if you're in a pinch financially, how are we going to have a plan for you in the event that that happens? Because we saw that happen for students in the spring semester. And so we tried to use those lessons that we learned from the spring to prepare better for the fall. We help students talk about basic needs. So again, on the food front, does your college campus have a food pantry? Increasingly, college campuses have these resources for students. And so we wanted them to be aware of their existence and know how to access them in the event that they needed to. And I think the hardest one to surface with students was, what do you do if you get sick with COVID? What happens if a loved one back at home gets sick with COVID?
These questions help students and their advisors make individualized plans that take into account their responsibilities as breadwinners, caregivers, and learners. And that's especially important since there's no perfect one-size-fits-all plan, especially during a pandemic.
Some students are really eager to go back to campus and have classes in person, to be living in a dorm or a nearby off-campus apartment. And some of that is because they need a safe place to be. They need access to stable internet. They need access to a place that they can work on their schoolwork without the distractions of noise of siblings or whatever else may be happening in their home environment. I have spoken with students who are really disappointed in how their campus has handled the reopening of the fall semester. So they're disappointed at the communication, the enforcement of masking and social distancing within the college student population on their campus. And so they're wishing they had access to more online classes and that they didn't need to be on campus as much in person.
Carissa points out that asking students what they need to support their unique circumstance is a major part of an equity-centered approach to education.
I think a lot of colleges, again, think that students are, the majority of their students are 18 years old, first-time college, first-time freshmen, who have full-time, who go to school full-time, who have means, who have, you know, a home life where there's a mom, a dad, and two kids, like in a house, right, and a dog. And for the vast majority of students in 2020 today do not fit that. And so even when we're thinking about our solutions, they have to be more student-centered, more equity-centered, more with a grasp of what their student population is actually like. Not what you would want it to be like, not what you aspire for it to be like, but your student population on your campus paying for it right now.
She suggests that this means expanding access to need-based financial aid.
One of the lead researchers who created what became the ACT-SAT believed that Black people were bringing the intelligence of America down as a nation.
She's talking about Carl Brigham, a psychology professor and member of the eugenics movement.
So, like, that is one of the people who made the standardized test scores that we use now to decide how to give out merit-based financial aid. So that aid, because of the structures of America, usually goes to people who are already wealthy and already going to go to college no matter what.
And even scholarships that are established in the name of diversity don't always produce equitable outcomes.
Diversity is just a mix. That's what diversity means. It means variety. Variety is cool and all, but equity means that I cannot predict educational outcomes based on race or based on class or based on immigration status, right? So outcomes, equity in the outcomes is what's important, not just diversity, right? Which is where a lot of colleges will go. A lot of colleges will also make that they've already started to make, like George Floyd memorial scholarships and things of that nature that they're doing wrong. So like if you're making a scholarship based on equity, maybe don't include an ACT score. Maybe don't include a GPA requirement, things like that. Maybe don't make it a one-year $500 scholarship that ain't gonna do nothing to help them with their mountain of debt.
She's been encouraging students to view themselves as consumers who pay for their education and have the right to demand financing and learning systems that work for them.
Look at the power structure. How is your money spent? Like if you, anybody who's out here talking about the uprising for Black lives, including colleges, including nonprofit organizations, foundations, hospitals, like any and every financial institutions, right? But I think it will take for colleges to really get honest about what they have done, what they've been doing to contribute to inequity. Colleges like to think of themselves as these like gateways, you know, to a better life, but colleges also perpetuate a lot of awful, awful things. And so looking within, who's the leadership, who's on the leadership teams, how much are they getting paid? I think all of that is really important.
She believes that when students collectively ask these questions of colleges, universities, and elected leaders, they can increase access to resources for future generations of students.
Part of my work at the foundation is organizing a statewide collective of students called the League of Student Advocates, and a part of their federal policy agenda that they've grown over the last few years is doubling the Pell Grant so that it can cover more larger proportion. A part of the state policy agenda is doing the same, divesting from merit-based aid that favors the wealthy and the privileged, and investing into need-based aid.
They've also been pushing for state lawmakers to reject higher education budget bills that include language about citizenship or immigration status.
Missouri in particular has very punitive policies around specifically access to education for undocumented folks, but punitive in general in relation to immigrants, whether you're documented or not.
In Missouri, public colleges and universities have been required to charge out-of-state or international tuition rates to students who are undocumented since 2015, which can differ from in-state tuition costs by $10,000 or more each year. This budget language is approved annually, but some lawmakers have been attempting to make this language permanent. Carissa points out that undocumented students in Missouri can't access emergency student grants through the CARES Act, an issue that has been hotly contested in congressional education committees.
We are making sure that folks understand their place in the world. So I think between advising and advocacy, we do a lot of just affirmations, like affirming to the young people we work with that you belong in any room you end up in. And don't let anybody tell you just because you're the first one there or the only one there that looks like you, that you don't belong. What's really been keeping me focused professionally is really the students. Honestly, that is the reason I go to work. Like, yes, I like looking at policies and not really budgets, but things like that. But what I really do it for is for the students, right? So nobody has to graduate with as much debt as I have. Personally, it's similar. It's community. I think whether that's my colleagues at the foundation, some of which are like family, my friends in the movement, my siblings, all of that, just knowing I can lean on folks and trying to be better at it because I have superwoman syndrome. So like trying to recognize that I can't hold it all has been critical for me.
Almost every day I wake up so incredibly grateful to do work that I love with people I love that is making a difference. There are few days that are easy because the work is oftentimes challenging, but I am lifted up by a group of colleagues who care about me as a professional and as a person, who challenge me and push me to grow. And I am just humbled by the students that we have the opportunity to connect with. On a more personal level, you know, I have 2 5-year-olds who they're the reason I have to get out of bed every morning because they're not going to let me stay in bed. But they remind me that, in all honesty, they remind me that there's a future ahead of us, one way or another. And I have to think about if I have this deep love and care for them that most parents and guardians do, and so I'm gonna fight like hell for them, and I expect that I should be fighting like hell for every other child out there, because everyone is deserving of everything, regardless of race or status of birth or anything like that.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.